From the studios of WHQR Wilmington, this is Coastline, WHQR's weekly talk show, featuring local guests plus your Wednesday questions and comments via calls and email. I'm Cleve Callison, sitting in today for Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. When was the last time you picked up a book? I mean a real, honest-to-goodness book with a spine and a cover and maybe a few dog-eared pages inside. If it's been too long, today's Coastline is for you. We're going to go back to the days before smartphones and tablets and talk about humankind's greatest invention after fire and country ham, books. It's our Desert Island Bookshelf show today. In the next hour, we'll talk about books and have some fun with three people in the area who know a lot about books. And I'll ask them and you for books that you absolutely must have. What would you rescue if you were stranded on a desert island with no cell phones or electricity? Just the few books that you were able to save when your dirigible crashes. What writers have made the greatest impact on you? Whom do you remember best? Have your favorites changed over the years? If you love the printed page, this is the show for you. So in this first segment of our show, we're going to do a little fruit basket turnover here during the show. And in this first segment, we're going to welcome Gwenifar Roller. She is proprietor of Old Books on Front Street, the queen of all media because she's the star of stage, screen, radio, and as of a couple of weekends ago, C-SPAN. So, Gwenifar,
nobody
welcome.
Could live up to that, but thank you.
It was such a treat to walk down the street and see you there with the C-SPAN van and their camera interviewing you in front of Old Books on Front.
It was truly a dream come true.
I'll bet.
When the producers called, they were like, do you know about book TV? I'm like, are you kidding? It's like crack.
We'll find out about that maybe as the show goes on.
C-SPAN didn't want to talk to me.
Oh, gosh.
Well, nevertheless, also with us today is the indefatigable, omnivorous reader, Ben Steelman of the Wilmington Star News. When he's not holed up in his favorite restaurant enjoying Grecian chicken with a book in one hand, no small feat, he writes about the arts, history, rumors, and general lore of the Cape Fear, all based on the fact that he really, really knows how to read. Welcome, Ben.
Howdy doody, and it's actually lasagna.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Lasagna?
Yes.
Well, I guess I'm the one who goes for Grecian chicken because I always see you on Wednesday.
Right.
Okay. And we'll also talk in the next segment with Jim Dodson, who is the editor of Salt Magazine, and we'll introduce Jim in the next segment of the show. So we welcome you in the audience to join our Wednesday conversation for the next hour. Let us hear from you with your emails to coastline@whqr.org or give us a call at any time. Our phone number is 910-343-1138. And you can email a question or comment for our guests. Everyone has a different list of favorite books. What are some of yours? What types of reading are you drawn to? How have your reading preferences changed since your early days? And now is your chance to let us hear from you. 343-1138 is our number. Who would like to start? Gwenifar, you were telling me you had a question about just the basic setup of the show. So
well,
maybe we should start with that.
So I have a very pragmatic mind at certain times. And when the original question came through, it was if you were stranded on a desert island, what are the 10 books you would want? So the first place my mind went was I would like a book on how to build shelters, shacks, and shanties. I would like a book on how to build your own boat. And
wow.
I would like a book on how to find your way without a map or a compass. And I would like a book on how Indians use wild plants for food and medicine. and then it occurred to me that maybe you actually meant what would I like to read if I were alone and uninterrupted by the cares of daily life.
Well, I was sort of thinking, suppose you were be stranded on a Caribbean island that had a resort there, but for some reason it's like the Twilight Zone. All the people were gone, but the toilet's flushed and
right.
You can take a shower and you get food and all that sort of thing.
So
you don't have to worry about any of the necessities of life other than books.
Right. Well,
but the library of this place is bare, so you have to bring them with you.
Shortly after that, I ran into Ken Campbell on the street and I was like, how can I pick one Shakespeare? And he kind of looked at me like I was nuts. I was like, oh, right, the Riverside Shakespeare. I can take the entirety
you
of Shakespeare's writing.
Yes, exactly.
Which you might or might not know this, Cleve, but I have a very powerful, passionate, intimate, deep, and very real relationship with the greatest writer that the English language has ever produced, named Mr.
That would
William
be Shakespeare.
William McGonagall?
So the idea that I could possibly be
Terry
without
Pratchett?
Him. Terry Pratchett's pretty darn good, but not quite there. The idea that I could be without him would be incredibly painful for me. So that was one that I really wanted. But on the note of Terry Pratchett, probably the book that I read once a week that I go back to over and over again is called Good Omens. It's a book that was co-written by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman about trying to stave off the apocalypse. And there's a lovely story that...
We're all there.
Right. Well, there's a lovely story Neil Gaiman tells about going to book signings and how almost every time somebody comes up with a just battered, ratty copy of Good Omens that's been taped back together four or five times, dropped in the bathtub, run over, et cetera, and asked him to sign it. And the realization finally came to him about 10 years ago that it's because it's a book that gets people through the hardest times in their lives.
Mm. Well, let's get back to that in just a minute, but I want to show you that I, too, brought a Shakespeare book.
Oh,
but
which one?
I couldn't find an anthology of, a book that had all his plays. That's one I really would take, but just for... As a visual aid, I read this wonderful book called Shakespeare A to Z, which has little – it's like a big dictionary of all the plays, and it has synopses of the plays and discussions of characters and actors and all kinds of things. It's really – it's a wonderful book. Let's go back to the Neil. Is it Gaiman or Gaiman? I've heard
two different pronunciations
just in the last 15 minutes.
I think it comes out Gaiman. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm a big fan of American Gods myself, and I love Stardust, so –
Anyway. Stardust is one of the most beautiful books I've ever read.
Yeah, it's one of these books that's officially for kids, but everyone will love it.
But this book she's talking about is co-written by Gaiman and Terry Pratchett.
Terry Pratchett.
Right, they were very good.
Whom
friends.
You don't care for?
Well, I like Pratchett okay. I mean, I have stepchildren who absolutely adore him. I mean, I just remember when Pratchett just recently died after a long fight with dementia. I mean, Gaiman wrote one of the most moving eulogies in the English language I've ever heard.
Yeah.
So I'm willing to reconsider him.
He's in many ways, if you like Douglas Adams, you would like Terry Pratchett.
Yes.
It's that same dry British sense of humor. And he's most well known for his Discworld series, so he's obviously done other things. The premise of Good Omens is that the demon who is the snake in the Garden of Eden and the archangel who was sent to throw Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden have been stuck on planet Earth together ever since and have become good friends. And that they find out that Armageddon is imminent and the Antichrist is being sent to Earth and they decide they have to stave it off. So they switch the babies and instead of growing up with Satanists, the Antichrist grows up in a nice middle class family and has friends and a dog and plays soccer. And it is the ultimate nature versus nurture experiment.
It should be pointed out that Kevin Smith some years ago stole the plot for this and cast it with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, but that's a whole other story.
And I guess I should also probably admit that I am partial to the book because the Archangel is a used bookstore owner.
Oh, well, that explains it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you go back and reread a book like that on a regular basis?
I read Good Omens about once a week.
Once a week?
Yeah.
How do you find time to do all this other stuff you're doing?
Well, it's my Prozac. I learned a long time ago that if I don't read every day and write every day, I become a human being. I can't stand to be around, and clearly nobody else could either. So it's
read
that,
and write every yeah, day.
It's either that or Prozac.
Okay. All right.
That's just honest.
All right, Ben, we started out with Gwennifer. What about you? What are some of the things on your list?
Well, I'm totally inept, so the guidebooks and the handbooks were no good for me. I figured that there are two basic rules to a desert island book. First of all, it has to be something that you have plenty of time to read. So you finally invest in the great big book you keep meaning to read.
Okay.
And secondly, I figured you're going to be down. You're going to be talking to Wilson the volleyball, and getting really really depressed and scraggly. So you need something that's going to make you laugh. So I sort of had a two-half list. On one half, you have things like James Joyce's Ulysses, which thank God I learned to appreciate through Gwennifer and her Bloomsday readings.
Thank you, Ben.
Anna Karenina by Tolstoy. All happy families are alike. Poor Anna winds up under the train every time you read it.
Darn! Spoiler alert.
Yes. And Anna looks either like Vivian Leigh, Greta Garbo, or Keira Knightley. And I'm also a very big fan of Confederacy of Dunces by John Gregory Toole, a massive novel which was written by a depressive man who committed suicide, and for some reason is one of the funniest books in the English language. And I'm also told
that's the one that it wouldn't have gotten published except his mother brought a manuscript copy to Walker Percy at a book reading or something.
That's right.
Like that.
And Walker Percy rolled his eyes. Anyone who deals with books has to get these manuscripts from the time, and he thought it was going to be one of those manuscripts. But he looked at it, and by gum, it was funny. And I'm also told that I resemble the lead character, Ignatius J. Riley, who is this rather scudsy, fat, oily guy with a dumb hat on his head, who basically spends a lot of time theorizing about the Middle Ages and how mankind has gone downhill since then. But his mother can't get him to take a real job. He winds up running a hot dog stand in St. Louis Square, and I think he eats most of the hot dogs. But anyway.
And gets involved.
One step above running a public radio station, as far as I'm concerned.
And it's rather timely, oddly enough, because there's this rather hapless character in the book named Officer Mancuso of the NOPD, and his boss keeps sending him into public restrooms to arrest perverts. So I just sort of had HB2 resonances off that. I don't know.
Wow. You're listening to Coastline here at WHQR. Our topic today is Desert Island Bookshelf, and we're going to welcome another guest in the next segment of the program. If you have nominations for books that are especially meaningful to you, ones that you'd like to take with you if you were stranded on a desert island, we would like to hear from you. Give us a call at 910-343-1138, or you can send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. And we'd love to hear from you as we welcome our guest today. 343-1138 is that phone number. We'll be back after a couple of minutes. Welcome back to Coastline here on WHQR. We are talking about books today. I'm with several folks who are very knowledgeable about books, and we'd like to hear from you. We'd like for you to be part of the conversation today and tell us what books you would take with you if you were stranded on a desert island, with all of the amenities, of course. The number to call is 343-1138, or you can call us, or you can send us an email to coastline@whqr.org. Ben Steelman is continuing. Gwenifer will be back later on, and now we welcome Jim Dodson. Jim is a native North Carolinian, a lover of sandy beaches, red clay farmland, and well-manicured golf courses.
There you go.
He's written a number of award-winning books, many of them about golf, and he's been the guiding light as editor behind outstanding regional publications O. Henry in Greensboro, Pine Straw in Southern Pines, and now Salt here in Wilmington. Jim, glad to have you here.
Thanks, Cleve. Good to be here.
Good. I don't know if you were able to hear the first segment.
I heard a little bit of it. Yep.
You heard a little bit of it?
Yep.
Okay, good. So you know the premise of this, mm-hmm. which is we're talking mm-hmm. about books that really are very meaningful to mm-hmm. us that we'd like to have with us if we were mm-hmm. stranded somewhere. So why don't you tell us what some of your nominees would be for that?
Well, I heard Ben say you're stuck on this island and you have only your books to keep you company. I have a mixture of books that are kind of history, my favorite novels, and essays. You know, I could start with Rudyard Kipling when I was a little kid, but I'll skip all the childhood books, which were just great. Mm. But E.B. White's essays were a real shaper of my writing life when I was in my teens and 20s.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I loved them. I still have them. I go back and read them all the time. So I'll just run through a group of them.
Sure, go ahead.
I sort of cheated on my list of 10. I added A and B's. Rick Atkinson, who's was a contemporary of mine at East Carolina. His wonderful trilogy on World War II. I'm a great history buff. My next book's a big history book about the Great Wagon Road that I'm writing. And
is The Day of Battle, is that one of his
Yeah,
books?
That was one of the trilogy. The Guns at okay. Last Light is about D-Day, and my dad went in at D-Day. And so it's a fabulous book. It's just one of the best military
I've read The Day of Battle, and I've started the next one.
Yeah, it sort of does for the European theater what Bruce Catton did for the Army of Northern Virginia.
It does, and the Guns at Last Light is just fantastic. It's just the detail and the horror of how nearly upside down the whole invasion went is just for any American, you should read it, and it gives you a powerful sense of that. I got to meet Walker Percy when I was a young journalist out of Atlanta, and I got to know him. And the Moviegoer is one of my favorite books. Mm-hmm. I've probably read it 8 or 9 times. My B on the Walker Percy list was The Second Coming, which when I went to – he invited me to dinner one night down in Covington, and we sat on his porch, and he told me about that book and gave me some great writing advice. And that I love that book. James Salter is another novelist I just adore. His book Light Years is one of the most elegiac, beautiful books you can possibly read. It's about a married couple in upstate, up the Hudson from New York, and about how their marriage dissolves. He also wrote a book called Sport and a Pastime that's really a kind of a iconic book about a young man in Paris in the late 50s after the war and sort of his adventures of the flesh and falling into sort of a dissolute crowd. Beautiful, gorgeously written book. He was probably the most poetic novelist that ever lived, mm-hmm. next to Flaubert. As a golfer, Herb Wind is a great friend of mine. In fact, he's in my new book, The Range Bucket List, that comes out in May. I have a whole chapter on Herb. Was kind of adopted me after Final Rounds came out. He was the great writer.
Final Rounds was the book about your father.
Yeah, that was 20 years ago. Yeah. And Herb was a great character. He was the godfather of golf writers. You know, the golf writing has a great, strong tradition of writing great writers. The joke is sort of, or the pun is that the smaller the ball, the better the prose. Herb was one of the greats, wrote for The New Yorker. He befriended me, and it's in my book. He wrote a wonderful book called Following Through.
Roger Angel or some other baseball writers might disagree with that.
But the ball's smaller than them, so we're not in the same category. No, there's some really great writers.
And then Roy Brown Jr. started off with football with a few bricks short of a load, so I don't think he's quite shabby either.
Well, I'm not demeaning the other sports, although I'm a big fan of Roger Angel. But golf had some wonderful writers. Bernard mm-hmm. Darwin, I mean, there's some of the fabulous writers. Henry Longhurst, one of the great mm-hmm. prose writers of all time. So there's just some because it's a game of suffering, golf. You know, it basically just doesn't give you –
prepares
anything.
You for life.
And nobody's applauding when you're playing. So, you know, there's
unless you're one of the rarefied top players of the world.
That's
then
true.
They applaud everything.
They do applaud, yeah. And then, back to my fictional list, The World According to Garp was such a big book when it came out, and I loved it. And I didn't think I'd like it, and I read it, and I really, really loved it. And so, you know, novels mean a lot to me, and so do the essays. I have two essays on my list. One is Anne-Mara Lindbergh's Gift from the Sea, which I taught when I was teaching memoir and history writing at Holland. That was a writer in residence there, and I taught Gift from the Sea, which is a beautiful, awesome – I recommend everybody that lives in this town keeps a copy of that and just reads it for proportion in life. And Barbara Round Taylor, who's I knew down in Atlanta, she's been called the top sermon writer in America. She's a wonderful Episcopal priest who now teaches religion out in western Georgia. She wrote a fabulous book called Seeing in the Dark, and one that called An Altar in the World. And they're really books about defining your spirituality and not in a religious sense. And she's just amazing. So that's sort of the bare bones of my list.
Okay. Probably can expand from that, I'm sure.
I can give you 50 or so more if you want.
Excuse me. Ben, what's your reaction to some of that?
Really good. What were your Reynolds Price books again?
Surface of Earth was the first. Well, I read A Long and Happy Life early in college, and I liked it okay. I mean, I come from the same kind of people he did, rural North Carolinians. He was Virginians. When I went to Atlanta at a young pup at 23 from Greensboro and was thrown into the magazine where Margaret Mitchell had written, and I just wandered into a bookstore and The Surface of Earth had just come out, and I read it and it just made me want to quit being a writer. You know, mm-hmm. I thought I can't write. No one can write that well. Mm-hmm. But that was not too long before I saw Walker Percy, and he kind of pumped me up again. So.
Yeah, I wrote a couple of little things when I was in college, but once I started reading Faulkner, I decided I can't, you know.
Oh, there we go.
You just have to stop.
I had the opposite experience with Faulkner.
Really?
I love the Reavers, and Sound and Fury, and I quit on Light in August.
Really?
Just he needs punctuation.
Sure, don't we all? Ben, your thoughts.
Light in August happens to be my personal favorite Faulkner novel for various reasons.
It's a good thing we're opposite the table, though. Mm-hmm.
Counterpoint
here.
For my list, I put on Absalom, mm-hmm. Which, of course, is the famous book that – it's sort of narrated by Quentin Compson, who's this young man from Mississippi
right.
who's up at Harvard
right.
and is trying to explain to his Canadian roommate what the South is. And he tells mm-hmm. this whole elaborate mm-hmm. story mm-hmm. about this poor kid – who's turned away from the door at a plantation and therefore yep. goes out by sheer force of will to turn himself into a rich man. But then it has this sort of Shakespearean downfall when he tries to form a dynasty and everything. And poor Quentin, who is, we know from another book,
right.
commits suicide, ends it saying, "I don't hate the South. I don't.
Yeah. Which, it may be heresy to admit that you're drawn to certain writers. One I left off is John Mortimer. I encountered him early, mm-hmm. and because
the
I'm an Anglophile.
Rumpole of the Bailey and all that.
A Voyage Around My Father, which is one of the great memoirs.
Yeah, that was a play. He wrote a memoir from the play that appeared. Yeah. I because I'm a pretty strong Anglophile and I spent a ton of time in England and belonged to an old club over there. I love going to England and Scotland and married into a Scottish family. And when Final Rounds came out, the BBG Ireland asked me to come over, and I went then to London, and a mutual friend of ours was going to get us together. I wanted to meet Mortimer because I think he's charming. He took the sort of comedy of manners and gave it a nice little edge that I love. And I love the Rumpole books. I've read them all several times. It's just you can't spend 20 minutes more joyful than reading a John Mortimer book. But Paradise Postponed is my favorite.
Yeah. That's Jim Dodson from Salt Magazine. Ben Stillman from the Star News is here. I'm Cleve Callison, and you're listening to Coastline. Our topic today, desert island books. What would you take with you if you only had a few books to go and for the rest of your life? Let's get – Jim, I'm going to ask you to put your headphones on because we've got a caller on the line,
okay.
and you won't be able to hear him unless you have the headphones. So we'll say the phone number for you to make your selection for this or your vote for this, 910-343-1138. And let's say hello to Adam from Wilmington. Adam, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Sure. Tell us about your book.
Well, one book which came to mind for me is Michael White from UNCW's Travels in Vermeer, a memoir. I thought that way on said island. Not only do you have a great book, but also through White's visual and emotional detail, you get to have some fine art with you as well. So perhaps I would choose a book dealing with the classic, kind of a two birds, one stone deal.
All right. Thank you very much, Adam.
Certainly a very fine book. White basically went off on this quest to see every single Vermeer painting that is known.
There aren't that many, only about
45 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the man is a poet, and he wrote about them brilliantly, and it's as close to actually being able to experience a painting without actually seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, it was justly praised.
Good idea. Thank you very much, Adam. Thanks for your call. You're listening to Public Radio. This is WHQR's Coastline. I'm Cleve Callison. The number again is 910-343-1138 or send us an email to coastline@whqr.org. Here's an email we got a couple of minutes ago, and this is from Lorraine, who says, "I'm a hopeless romantic. I would be happy with Gone with the Wind and Pride and Prejudice." Now, what do you think? Jane Austen was one of my top 10.
Yes.
I don't know if it'd be Pride and Prejudice or something else, but maybe
that's
an anthology of three or four of them.
Well, Jim, what did you find out about Margaret Mitchell working at the old Journal Constitution magazine?
I was the youngest writer it was the oldest Sunday magazine in the nation, and I was their youngest writer ever at 23, and from North Carolina to complete the heresy. They really wondered what they'd gotten themselves into. And they they played a kind of prank on me. I mean, the magazine was small. There were three writers and two editors and the art department and photographer between the Constitution and Journal. And so they marched me in. They gave me this old desk, and they said, "Now, don't deface this desk. This desk belonged to Margaret Mitchell when she was
wow.
a senior writer here." Well, I believed that for about 2 years until the old editor, Andy Sparks, was retiring. And his wife, by the way, Olive Ann, I was the first person to get to read her wonderful book called Cold Sassy Tree.
Mm.
That was a huge bestseller. And he told me, he said, "Jim, that's really not Margaret Mitchell's desk." At which point I started putting my chewing gum under it to face it. So I left my mark on that desk.
They probably told every new writer that. Yeah.
Well, they didn't have many. Everybody on there was ancient. So uh-huh. I felt very much in – I mean, I was like a child.
Was there anybody there who had personally known?
Yeah, Martin? There was. A woman named Margaret Shannon, who was in her late 60s, early 70s, had been there since Margaret Mitchell. Margaret wrote Gone with the Wind while she was on the staff, and then it hit the big time and she quit. And then she got killed by a cab, I think, crossing the street in front of
drunk driver on Peachtree Street.
So,
as a teenager, by the way, I should point out she came. She spent a couple of summers at Wrightsville mm-hmm. Beach in one of the old hotels.
Mm.
And it's kind of interesting. Gone with the Wind is denounced today, of course, for romanticizing the Moonlight
right,
and Magnolias
and
overlooking a few things like slavery.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting. In the 1930s, it was regarded as heretical and as basically just terribly revisionist for suggesting that not all Confederates were pure and spotless. I mean, poor Mrs. Bellamy over at the Bellamy Mansion mm-hmm. wrote an extended refutation of it called Back with the Tide as opposed to Gone with the Wind, which is
– Well, I'm going to tell you
– You can actually find a copy over at the Bellamy Mansion gift shop if you ever want to check it out.
Yeah, I will. There's a lovely book that I read. I try to dip into contemporary fiction a lot, but I don't usually get very far. I get two chapters in, because I have to read so much else. And when I'm writing a book, I can't read anybody else. So one I dipped out of, I found last year and absolutely loved. I read it twice. It's a book called Small Blessings by I think Martha Woodhouse. I think is her name. I think she's a North Carolinian, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It was her first novel, and it's about a mythical little town, little college town that I sort of imagine is something like Hollins is up in Virginia. And it's about a English professor with a very difficult wife who kind of falls for the new book woman running the bookstore. And it's your classic picaresque comedy of manners in a southern setting that is really very sweet and really captures kind of the ivied conceits of a small town college beautifully, and it's funny and charming. And I read it twice. I loved that book. I don't know her. I'm just a fan of that book, and it's called Small Blessings. And if you want to spend two lovely or three evenings reading, that's a great little book.
Let me take a minute and ask the two of you about something else that you're involved in separately. Ben, you've got a prologue coming up next week. I believe. Isn't that right?
That is right. It comes up
Tell
monthly.
Us about that. Who are you going to be talking to?
Dorothy Papadakis, which is rather unusual.
The organist.
Yeah. This is a lady. She spent, I think, 20 years, was 10 or 20 years playing for the Cathedral of St. John with the Divine.
Mm-hmm.
She used to jam with the Paul Winter Consort.
Mm-hmm.
And she travels the country doing at Halloween and now Mardi Gras doing organ accompaniment to silent horror movies like
– Well, she's done that at St. Paul's Church.
St. Paul's,
here, right?
Jekyll and Hyde, the Hunchback. Anyway, she always dresses up for the occasion. I don't know what she's going to do here. She's written or rather transcribed, as she pointed out, a fantasy novel sort of in the vein of J.K. Rowling in which nature basically responds to to climate change. Mm.
Nice.
She's bringing props to show that these things are real, and I don't know what in the world is going to happen here. But friends, we're going to try to hold on.
That's going to be Monday night. That'll take place here at the WHQR studios at 254 North Front Street.
Admission is free, and refreshments will be served.
Yes, 7 p.m. So join Ben Steelman and Dorothy Papadakis for Prologue. And let me just ask you, Jim, I thought I heard you say a couple of years ago that you were done writing golf books, but you said earlier that Well, but you're still working on one.
No. This is my – all right, when Final Rounds came out, or years after it came out, and it was a surprise, very big surprise bestseller, people have always said to me all over the world, and Hospice gives that book out, and it's just never stopped in 20 years. And people – I get all these letters, and people say, why didn't you write another book like that? I mean, it's a very personal book. You can only write a book like that once. But what I did have was 30 years in the golf world meeting remarkable people. Arnold Palmer's autobiographer, and we became great close friends. He asked me as a result of Final Rounds to write his book. So this book, I decided I could write this one book we call The Range Bucket List. When I was moving my mother out of her house in Greensboro, I found this little notebook that had 11 things I wrote on it called My Things to Do in Golf when I was 11 years old. Mm. The irony is I did them all. I got to meet Bobby Jones, Arnold Palmer. Cool. I never got to play on the PGA Tour, but I did make it to the U.S. Open as a reporter. And so it's really kind of it's my love poem to golf. And I figured this is my farewell love poem to the game I love, not the PGA Tour, not the stars, but it, you know, as Hogan's biographer, I got so many great stories behind the scenes, and I became friends with people like Glenn Avare and John Updike, and it's a funny, funny book about this golf life I never happened to have, never planned, and four of my books were books of the year. I never imagined that could happen.
So I have to ask, what was Bobby Jones like?
Oh, I didn't. I met his daughter, lived in Greensboro.
Oh.
But in the book, I talk about meeting him. This is way more than I can talk about here, but when I was ready to leave the Atlanta Constitution magazine, a guy asked me to come out to Eastlake, and I had not played golf in 7 years because all I did was work covering presidential campaigns and crime in the New South. And I met Bobby Jones at the old club. His spirit with his best friend took me around, so I tell that story. It's a very sweet story.
Very good. Are you going to
May 9th,
be part of the PGA thing here at Eagle Point?
We're covering it in Salt enormously. I'll obviously be there, and I'm doing a speaking thing when the book comes out in May.
Okay. We're going to have to say goodbye to Ben Steelman. We'll bring Grenofar Roller back in to finish out this hour. Talking with Jim Dodson, I'm Cleve Callison. The program is Coastline. We'd like to hear your thoughts about what books you would take with you to a desert island. Our number is 910-343-1138. Our email address is coastline@whqr.org. We'll be back. Welcome back to the final segment of today's Coastline here on WHQR. I'm Cleve Callison here with Gwenifar Roller from Old Books on Front Street and Jim Dodson from Salt Magazine. We've said goodbye to Ben, so we have Gwenifar and Jim here with us for this final section of the program, talking about desert island books, books that you would take with you if you had nothing else to do for the rest of your life except read a small set of books. What would they be? The number to call to tell us what that is 910-343-1138, or you can let us hear from you online at coastline@whqr.org. Welcome back, Gwenifar.
Thank you very much.
I see you've written something on the back of your palm there. Are
those Palm Pilot.
Arr.
I only have three more years that joke is going to work. I've got to use it while I can.
Thank you. We do have an email that came in to coastline@whqr.org. This is from John, and John says his book that he would choose is Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. He says it creates a complex world of its own, although perhaps it's a world a person goes to a desert island to escape from. Nevertheless, it's captivating and entertaining, and I would bring it along for his incredible command of modern American English. I would also be sure to pack his essay collection, especially A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, and the title essay of which seems especially relevant to a constructed type of vacation paradise. Okay, so that's from John. Thank you, John. Either of you David Foster Wallace fans?
I adore David Foster Wallace, but...
But that's not one that would be on your list to take?
That actually is a good segue for sort of one of the decision-making criteria for me. So Consider the Lobster is another one of his collection of essays, which is one of my favorite books. But there are things that you love because they are in context with the world you live in, and that's why they're important, and that's why they're relevant, and that's why they have meaning for you. And if I am not having to interact with all of that, then that changes the experience of reading that book. Does that make any sense? So, like, for example, Just Above My Head by James Baldwin is another book that I absolutely adore, but it has meaning and importance for me because of the messages that it still deals with the reality of life for African Americans, for gay people, the struggles of dealing with mourning and loss. And if none of those are issues that are part of life in this perfectly constructed paradise, then that changes the experience of reading the book. But I will tell you what we say about Infinite Jest when people think about buying it at the bookstore. Because if you haven't seen it, I mean, it's a mammoth book. It's over 900 pages, and it's sort of famous for its length and its density. And one of the things I frequently say to people is, just read the first 150 pages because you love this man's relationship with language. It's going to take a while for the plot to emerge. You know, you're not on page one. You are not going to know.
But
what
if you're
this
on a desert island, you've got all the time in the world stretching out ahead of you.
But every sentence is beautiful. Yeah. Like, I mean, that's the thing. Like, his relationship with how he puts a sentence on the page is stunning, almost erotic.
Yeah. You're listening to Coastline. Our topic is Desert Island Bookshelf. We've got about 13 minutes left in this show. And our phone number for you to make a contribution to this is 910-343-1138. And we're going to say hello now to Juanita, who's calling from Carolina Beach. Juanita, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Well, because I'm trying to figure out things and I really haven't, I would take the Quran and the Bible. And in that same vein, because I kind of don't understand all poetry, I take a big anthology of poetry. And because I've never read War and Peace, and it would take me forever, I would take War and Peace. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Juanita. I appreciate the phone call.
You know, I have a great suggestion for Juanita, and I got it. I was an English major long before I got to East Carolina. But I remember one of the – for the freshman English class I took, we got the Norton Anthology of British Poetry.
Right.
And I still have that book. It's still on my desk. And, in fact, my daughter's a writer in New York City, and she called me the other day. She wanted to know about English Romantic poets, and I went out and bought her a giant volume of and had it FedExed up to her. You can never go wrong starting, you know, with Andrew Marvell and John Donne and working your way up to, you know, to T.S. Eliot and through the Romantic period especially of these writers. The language is beautiful. The poetry is sublime and meaningful. And, you know, as I was telling her, the message of the Romantic Age poets is not about personal human romance necessarily. In fact, very little. It's really about man's relationship to his world around him. So you have Wordsworth writing about Tintern Abbey's decaying and nature reclaiming it. And I guess I marvel at how so many people today don't realize that the power of that poetry. So Juanita, bravo for you. I can get you a cheap copy of Norton's anthology if you need it.
Good. Yeah, that's a good resource. I'm going to be teaching a class in poetry for Ollie. And I'm going to just stay completely away from any biographical details about the people and just look at the poems themselves. So we'll see how that goes. You're listening to Coastline on WHQR. I'm Cleve Callison. And our guests today are Jim Dodson and Gwenifer Roller. We had a caller on the line who did not want to stay on the line, but Liz from Wilmington said Anything or Everything by J.R.R. Tolkien would be her choice. So that's a good one.
It is.
Here's the number to call, 343-1138, or online, coastline at whqr.org. Now, Gwenifer, you brought in a number of books, and we got through three or four of them at first. Do you want to pick up from there?
Sure. Well, so I had a variety of stacks. I had my pragmatic stack, which we sort of looked at, which was if I'm stranded, how the heck am I getting home?
Yeah. We got that covered.
Yeah. So
I'm going to bring my copy of the Scout Field Book, which is a wonderful thing that tells you how to tie all sorts of knots and how to fell a tree, clear the ground, an axe length around, you know, that sort of thing. So we'll take care of all
that. Good. Glad to hear it. And so then I had sort of two other stacks. And one was, you know, in a purely perfect world, what would I want? And then the others are books that are important to me that I love to reread. But again, it is because of the society we live in. And if you want, I can do that really fast.
Go ahead. So, just reel them off.
Sure. Well, The Moon is Down by Steinbeck, Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury, 1984 by Orwell.
A great book about books.
Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, The Monkey Wrench Gang by Ed Abbey, the autobiography of Malcolm X, John L's The Trail of Tears, and Elie Wiesel's Night and Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here.
Wow.
But again, those are
verging
books
on the political there.
Right, but
yeah,
they're books that have meaning because of the world you live in. And if you remove the context of what is happening around you and what has led you up to this moment, and you're reading purely for pleasure, that's a very different thing. So I surprised Isabel Shepherd earlier when we were talking. I was like, well, one of the books I would take with me just purely for pleasure is St. Dale. And she looked at me, she said, what's that? And I said, oh, it's a fabulous book about NASCAR. It's the Canterbury Tales meets NASCAR.
Like Dale Earnhardt.
Right. Yeah. So it's a year. The premise is it's a year after Dale Earnhardt has died. Huh. And there are a group of pilgrims on a tour of the holy sites of Dale Earnhardt, and he is working miracles from beyond the grave. And it's probably the only book that manages to get Chaucer, NASCAR, and Latin jokes all in the same place.
That sounds like
it's amazing.
Two-thirds of my kind of book.
Right. And so there's that. Obviously, the Oxford English Dictionary is my favorite book ever. And, that's a whole lifetime of reading. You'll never finish it. And every time you go back to an entry, you see something.
Yeah, think how much history and everything else you learned.
You know.
While we have a few minutes, do you mind if I
please
dip into my book? I just went through my bookshelf last night and started pulling things off. The Once and Future King.
Yeah, great.
I can never get my wife to read this book. But we're going to go see Camelot this summer at Opera House Theater.
Great.
So I'm going to try to see if I can get her to read
this
book. We'll break your heart. I started to bring The Golf Omnibus by P.G. Woodhouse, but instead
that was on my early list.
I've got The World of Mr. Molyneux.
Yeah.
But really, the one I would take are The Collected Stories of Jeeves. I mean, you just can't beat that. I showed you the Shakespeare book. Here's my portable Faulkner.
Yeah.
I know that's anathema to you, Jim.
Yeah, it's a doorstop.
Yeah, yep. The King James Bible.
There you go.
Yeah, got to have that.
Yeah.
Walt Kelly's Pogo.
Wow.
Let's see, what have I got? Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility. Oh, I did bring The Golf Omnibus by P.G. Woodhouse.
There he is. He's great. Wonderful.
And my last one is The Preface to Paradise Lost by C.S. Lewis. You know, many people encounter Lewis in a theological context, but for me, he's the greatest critic of English literature that ever lived. And the chapter here about Satan is just maybe the most wonderful chapter of any book I've ever read in my life.
Wow. Well, that's like Barbara Brown Taylor. That's why she's on my list. She writes the same kind of way, a little lower or higher, depending on than the spiritual realm. When you mentioned Ray Bradbury, just to toss in, and it's wonderful collection. His collection of short stories are absolutely sublime.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, people don't even realize how many great short stories he wrote, some of which he developed into books. But there's a big anthology of his short stories, and I just heartily recommend them. They're beautiful things.
Mm-hmm. 343-1138 is the number to call. We've got a few minutes left to get your suggestions for your favorite books that you would take with you to a desert island. 343-1138.
You know, P.G. Woodhouse is an interesting character in and of himself. Most people think he's British, but of course he was American.
Well, he was born in England, wasn't he?
No, I think he was from upstate New York. He moved to England very early.
Oh, really?
I think so.
I knew he had moved from England to New York and started writing for the Saturday Evening Post and
I think he's an American.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I could be wrong. It's been 25 years since I wrote a piece about him. But you know, the brain leaks after a while.
Yeah. But Jeeves and Worcester just can't be beat.
No.
Gwenifer, what was the first one you said in that last list?
Just Above My Head or The Moon Is Down.
Oh, okay. I don't know that writer at all.
Just Above My Head is the last book that Baldwin finished before he passed
away. Oh, James Baldwin. Yeah, okay.
And it's –
I'm not familiar with that.
An amazing – so one of the things that drives me crazy because I'm a book snob – is everybody talks about Go Tell It on the Mountain, which is an amazing book and was his breakthrough novel. And at the time, it was very surprising considering what he was tackling and how. But when you read Just Above My Head, you're like, no, this is the book you spent your whole life preparing to write. Oh, dear God. And it's gorgeous. It's incredible.
You said people call you a book snob. Do you think of yourself that way?
I think that most people would be surprised at what my taste actually is, you know, because I think a lot of people expect that what I like is very what I would call Iowa School of Writing or the New Yorker Magazine Voice, when actually I find that very pretentious and boring. I like commercial fiction that people actually want to read.
Speaking of commercial fiction, I'd be remiss if I didn't – a book that just blew me away when I was 12 years old was To Kill a Mockingbird. And
oh, yeah.
Partly because my dad owned a newspaper in Mississippi when I was very young, and I have my earliest memories of life are a very small town that was so hot in summer, women's collars wilted by noon, and it was very much like that world. I actually went over to see her when I was at the Constitution, and she agreed to see me but wouldn't talk to me about her book.
Really?
Yeah, over in Monroeville, Alabama. And, she, you know, she was a recluse, and she almost agreed. A wonderful old lady that was wonderful, Celestine Sibley, who's a legend in Georgia, knew her. And
she worked
got her
the paper,
to,
didn't
yeah,
she?
She did.
Yeah,
at the Constitution. She kind of took me under her wing.
Uh-huh.
She's the one that said to me, Jim, if you ever get famous, and she predicted, she said, you'll be a wonderful writer, and writers are going to call you and ask you how to write. And she said, my advice is, say, go to college and hang up on them. Because she was very funny, very proper lady. she was a character. But she set it up, and I drove all the way over to Monroeville, Alabama, and she would see me and said hello, and that was all she would talk. So
I'm kind of surprised that none of us has put Eudora Welty on the table. You know, just think about that.
Yeah, the Optimist's Daughter was a fabulous book, and that's another one Celestine set up. She did speak to me. She's the one who told me I was talking to her, and I said I saw her in Atlanta. Although I did drive over and see her, she said, I asked her, why did the South have so many great writers? And she said, very simple, son, it's poaches.
Poaches. I said, sitting on the poach.
And I said, porches. And she said, yes. She said, yeah, we grew up in a time when that's where you got all your news, your gossip, you swap stories. And
yeah.
And she later told that to the New York Times, so I thought I kind of got a scoop.
And now everybody sits on their deck. So
that's
that
right.
Doesn't
that's
help.
Right.
Well, we're going to go to our next caller here. We've got just a couple of minutes here, so I'm going to say hello to Patrick from Wilmington. Patrick, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air, and you'll have to make it quick, I'm afraid.
Hi.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi. My suggestion was this James Joyce, Ulysses.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you guys had mentioned him, but
Ben Steelman mentioned that as one of his choices at the beginning of this show. Yeah, good one.
Oh, okay. I guess I missed that.
What makes that one of your favorites?
Well, I think it would just be good for Desert Island to pass the time because it's just infinite references and puzzles. And, you know, even if you finish it, there's still so much you can get out of it. I guess the only caveat would be I would also want the annotated Ulysses alongside of it. But there's a lot of
to help you get through it.
1915 Ireland references that I wouldn't get.
Yeah. All right, Patrick, thank you very much. We appreciate hearing from
you.
We'll put that down on the list. Either of you fans of Ulysses or Joyce?
Well, we host Bloomsday every year at the
bookstore.
So,
yes, and I had a lot of fun doing that with Bob Workman a few years ago.
Eventually we'll make it through the whole book. We're on year 6 and we still haven't finished it yet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I never read it. I started it, didn't finish it. I think I got about 6 pages. And Sheila Yates, the famous poet's granddaughter, interviewed me once on Ireland Radio and asked me that very question, and she was appalled when I admitted I hadn't read the book.
No.
So.
All right. That's going to have to be it for today. My guests today on this program have been Jim Dodson, editor of Salt Magazine, Gwyneth R. Roller, proprietor of Old Books on Front, and earlier in the show, Ben Steelman of the Star News. So thank you both for being here today. This has been fun, and the hour has gone pretty quickly on our Desert Island Bookshelf program. Join us tomorrow for another edition of Coastline with your regular host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and she'll be back next week for both Wednesday and Thursday's show. Coastline's producer is Isabel Shepherd, and filling in for Isabel today is Emily Fulbright as our phone screener and Twitter wrangler. Ken Campbell provided audio engineering today. I'm Cleve Callison. I'm the executive producer of Coastline, and I want to thank you for listening to this broadcast on WHQR Wilmington, 91.3 FM, 98.9 in Myrtle Beach, and 94.1 in Lumberton. Join Rachel tomorrow on Coastline. And thanks for being with us on today's edition of Coastline.